This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's radio.
Free
radio.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream.
Let me clear space for you to sit beside me. You don't need your back against the wall.
You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Feminists have long argued against the notion of innate female or male characteristics, pointing out the ways in which socialization impacts and shapes our behavior and experiences. Yet a recent study out of Penn Medicine claims that there are, in fact, hardwired differences between male and female brains that explain why men are supposedly better at certain tasks than women and vice versa. I spoke with Rebecca Jordan Young about the study. Jordan Young is a socio-medical scientist at Barnard College and the author of Brainstorm, The Flaws in the Science of Sex Differences. I spoke with her over the phone from her home in New York. So I wonder, first of all, have you read about the study that just came out from Penn Medicine about neurological differences in male and female brains?
Yeah.
So, I mean, to start, I know it's a simple question that's probably got a very complicated answer, but I wonder if you can tell me, are there neurological differences between male brains and female brains?
Well, you know, it seems like a simple question, but it isn't a simple question because the very word difference means a lot of different things. So what counts as difference? Do all people in one group have to have a certain pattern, or is an average difference enough? Are you talking about an absolute kind of a difference in kind, or a difference that maybe exists if you test, you know, 1,000 people and you have different groups in that, then you can pick up tiny little group differences on average and so on. You also would want to know, you know, does it matter if there might be a difference that you see in one group, but you don't see it in a different group, and we could go on and on like that. So to ask, are there neurological differences between male and female brains, there are very, very few stable differences that have been shown. And then there are things that, you know, there are different kinds of differences mean, you know, are you talking about structure? Are you talking about what this latest study looked at, the connectome, meaning what's the pattern of connections in different parts of the brain, and so on? So whether they're there, just a flat answer to that in terms of yes or no will almost always give you a misleading response, because different people read into that question a very different understanding of what counts as a difference, and do they mean structure, function, different types, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, and so I wonder, is it possible, for example, for men to be better at certain activities? This study talked about, you know, for example, men were better at tasks like reading maps than women were, you know, and they also referred to the differences that they found as pronounced and as reflecting behavioral complementarity. You know, I wonder if that's something possible, and if it's possible for those kinds of differences to be attributed to neurological differences specifically.
Right. Well, there are a couple of different parts, again, to this particular question. So, you know, is it possible that there are differences like that? Sure there are. And there are differences that you could find. You could also, you know, if you were to test a bunch of kids who were, you know, English majors versus sociology majors, you could find any number of differences between them. If you test males and females, you might find some differences. But what's interesting to know is, what do you see over a bunch of different studies, and what other kinds of things do they control for? One of the big problems in this particular study is that they didn't tell us much about the subjects. We don't know about things like what kinds of hobbies they had, what kinds of activities they do, what kinds of families they come from, and so on. All of that stuff actually matters a lot to brain activity. So you know, the question of reading maps, that's a really interesting one. There's a lot of study on the idea of navigational differences between males and females. And many studies find that there are differences, but the interesting thing is that those differences are not stable from one study to the next. So there are questions about, number one, how do they arise? But number two, how might they change? You know, experience and small kinds of differences in training and experience and activities change the way people navigate. They change the way they read maps. They can even change people's own body sense of orientation in space. So one of the most important things to understand when you're thinking about brain differences is we tend to think if you see a brain difference and then you see a behavior difference that correlates with it, that that behavior difference must come from what we see in the brain. But it's just as likely that any difference we see in the brain actually comes from differences in behavior. The brain responds to what we do in the world, how we learn, the activities we practice on a daily basis. So the interesting thing to me is, you know, the way in which this particular study makes some speculations about how the connection differences they found at a group level might relate to functional differences. That's a really big weak spot in this particular study. It's an interesting study. It's interesting to look at connection differences. But then what I would want to know is, actually, I'd like to see some actual investigation of how those differences might come about. And what they did instead was a common but unfortunate strategy of just, when you compare males and females, you just assume that any difference you see must have been there from the very beginning, and it must just be due to the very something about the physical fact of sex, instead of taking into account lots of other ways that, you know, the social worlds of males and females are structured quite differently. So something like gaming, video gaming, is a really interesting example. Video games are very gendered. They are created and marketed to fit sort of gendered norms and gendered patterns of behavior. And some of those video games that are specifically popular with boys and created for boys and marketed for boys actually develop certain kinds of spatial skills. Now, that doesn't mean that girls can't develop those spatial skills, but there are interesting studies out there that show that if you give even a few hours of practice on video games that use target shooting, you can really shift certain spatial skills that used to be thought of as just hardwired male favoring differences. You know, it leads from this question, is it possible that there are differences? Sure, it's possible, and we see lots of differences. The much more interesting question is, how do they come about? Do we see those same differences from group to group? But also, a really big one, when you see a structural difference of some sort, what does that actually tell you about function? Mm-hmm. And they make a lot of leaps in this study that aren't really warranted.
Yeah, so it sounds like part of what's missing is that socialization impacts our brains and the way that our brains work. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. And what's tricky here, you know, to be really fair, I mean, it might sound like I'm just picking on these cognitive scientists. It's not like that, actually. I work with cognitive scientists. One of my most important mentors is a wonderful cognitive scientist. And what you don't hear people saying in my field, you know, or at least in the gender studies part of my field very often, you don't hear people say, well, socialization is so fuzzy and poorly measured. But in fact, that's a really important issue. When we say socialization affects the brain, what we actually know from empirical studies is only about tiny little slices of experience. We can look at how small interventions, like the one I mentioned a minute ago, playing a video game, can affect brain structure, even over just the course of a fairly short number of hours, or something like learning to juggle or playing the piano. It's that all those things create actual structural differences in the brain. So we go from that. We then extrapolate to big patterns of socialization, like gender socialization. But gender socialization is huge, and there are patterns in it, but it's also not exactly the same for everybody. The way middle-class kids in New York City are socialized to be masculine or feminine is very different from the way middle-class kids in Bombay are socialized to do that. And the way, you know, working-class kids in Bombay or in Kansas City, and we could go on and on with that. So what we can do is look at very specific things and then think about what are the gendered patterns that might mirror those specific kinds of activities and how they affect the brain and behavior, and then how would something that's really multiple and lifelong, and that's at this point starts literally before birth, socialization and expectations about gender, you know, they amplify all of these particular differences, but they also leave room. They're not as precise as, you know, teaching everybody the same video game for a certain number of hours. So does socialization affect the brain and behavior? Absolutely. There's no question that it does.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't study something as boundless in a way as gender. You can't study that directly. What you can do is study parts of it. You can study things that are associated with gender. You can specifically measure what kinds of tasks and hobbies and activities and attitudes people have, and then take a look at how that might be correlated with the way their brains are structured or the way they behave. But too often, what people do instead, if they just simply code their subjects as male or female, and then they act as if, you know, that everything that they see that's different between the two groups is just somehow coming from some original biology that springs unformed from DNA or hormones or whatever. And there's very little effort to really look concretely at the kinds of gendered experiences also play into these things.
Mm-hmm. And I know that when, you know, I, for example, as a feminist, will often argue that gendered behavior is socialized as opposed to innate. You know, that's a big part of feminist theory. But often people will respond by pointing to the behavior of children, and they'll say, oh, well, you know, the boys were always more rambunctious since they were young. You know, there wouldn't have been a chance for socialization even yet, and they were always more active, more rambunctious, more aggressive, or whatever. Or they'll say, you know, the girls were all drawn to babies and to dolls, and you know, my daughter was just naturally nurturing. How do you respond to these kinds of arguments?
Well, my favorite way to respond to that is by describing whole bunch of wonderful studies that I think of collectively as the Baby X studies. There's a huge amount of research out there on how people's expectations and beliefs about gender affect what they see, and they affect the way we perceive people's behavior. What's interesting is gendered expectations have the biggest effect when behaviors are ambiguous. And where are they most ambiguous? Often they're very ambiguous in babies, because babies can't tell us precisely what they're thinking or feeling. They're not actually talking and so on. So people project a whole lot of gendered stuff onto them. As a really great example, there's this classic video that was the study, I mean, it was done years ago, by filming the exact same baby. They filmed this baby, dressed it just in neutral clothes, and then they showed the baby reacting to a bunch of different toys. And they filmed it, and in the film, it reacted to a lot of different toys. And they showed the film, and sometimes they told people that the baby they were watching was a girl, and sometimes they told them it was a boy. And they just asked people to describe the reactions the baby was having, what was going on. There was one particular sequence where the baby got very upset at a particular toy and began to cry. When they thought the baby was a girl, Overwhelmingly, the people described the child as afraid. When they thought that the child was a boy, they described that child as angry. Mm-hmm. And they were all watching the exact same film. Now, you know, a lot of people might be tempted to say, look, that's a really old study that was done in the 70s. You don't see it anymore. But it turns out very recent studies find similar things. Mothers, even those mothers who on a questionnaire will say, and they report attitudes that are very non-sexist, they're very egalitarian, if they're asked to estimate their baby's capability to, say, crawl up a ramp, the mothers of boys tend to overestimate their ability and their strength. The mothers of girls tend to underestimate it. And the really kind of humbling thing here is it doesn't matter whether you're a feminist or not. You're still carrying around these gendered stereotypes and expectations. I think a lot of times people expected that just having a critique of sexism and, you know, feeling that it was wrong and trying to be open, people thought that was going to be enough. And then when gender didn't go away because of our belief in equality and our good intentions, or when we as feminists still perceived, you know, gender in the little children around us, whether they're our children or other people's children, it's really easy to think, wow, it's just coming from them. And I think part of that is because it's really troubling to come to grips with the fact that we're still carrying around very sexist beliefs. But what it says to me is we have to take seriously that, you know, we have these what are called implicit beliefs. You know, we're affected by the stereotypes, whether we want to be or not. And, you know, we have to take a look at what do good studies say about this. And unfortunately, this is an arena where, you know, our own gut instincts and experiences are not really very reliable.
Right. I wanted to, you know, finally talk about gender dysphoria and that idea that, you know, some people feel that they have a female brain or a male brain, and, you know, they might say, you know, I feel as though I have a female brain, but I'm trapped in a male body. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, how does that work? I mean, is it possible for someone to have a male brain or a female brain at the end of the day? And how does that connect to gender dysphoria?
Well, I think, you know, you've asked a really good question in there, which my favorite part of the question is it possible for someone to have a male brain or a female brain at the end of the day? And I think when you're talking about humans, there's not really any point in talking about male or female brains. I don't think that that really has any meaning when you talk about humans. I think that if you're talking about other species, you get into murkier territory because there are more clear-cut differences. But so the best way, though, that I would address the question of, you know, gender identity and people, transgender people who feel that their brain or their mind is different from their body, I don't actually think that's any different from all the women out there who feel like they have a female brain and all the men out there who feel very, very confident that they have a male brain. I don't think that, you know, transgender people are any different in that way than non-transgendered people. I mean, culturally, in our broad society, we have a very, very strong belief in biological essentialism, that the feelings that we have, that the way we perceive ourselves in the world, the kind of personalities we have and so on, come from certain things about our biology. And I think that, you know, there are lots of reasons why that's such a strong belief, but I don't think that it's either any different for transgender people or that we necessarily have to trust that as a narrative any more in transgender people than we do in anybody else. But I also don't think we should be more critical of it in transgender people than we are of anybody else. You know, I don't think there are folks out there who really like to pick on trans people for this sense and for making that statement, but, you know, they're hardly the only ones that are proclaiming that we are who we are because of something about our brains. I think that it's also really important to note here that medical and scientific communities have really built this narrative up and have done a lot of studies that create a structure that, you know, is all about trying to find an explanation for gender nonconformity in having a different brain or in having different kinds of hormone exposures or whatever. So transgender people didn't just make this narrative up. It comes from a long scientific history that has to do with trying to find reasons for socially important differences inside people's bodies. And usually the kinds of things that are looked for are things that are devalued. So, you know, again, I'm skeptical of it because of the way I understand the brain as an extremely flexible and responsive organ, and because of the way that, you know, that I don't really think there is a meaningful male brain or female brain. So whether you're trans or not, to say that's what explains your behavior doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. I know I've taken up a lot of your time, and I really appreciate it. I know you're busy again. It's been really interesting to talk to you and to look more closely at this topic for sure. It's really interesting.
Great.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
You just heard an interview with Rebecca Jordan Young, author of Brainstorm, The Flaws in the Science of Sex Differences. For more on her work, visit RebeccaJordan-Young.com. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.